Then the king commanded, and they brought those men which had accused Daniel, and they cast them into the den of lions, them, and their children and their wives. And the lions had the mastery over them, and brake all their bones in pieces, wherever they came at the bottom of the den. Then Darius wrote unto all people, nations, and languages that dwell in all the earth, peace be multiplied unto you. I make a decree that in every dominion of my kingdom men tremble and fear before the God of Daniel, for he is the living God and steadfast forever, and his kingdom that which shall not be destroyed, and his dominion shall be even unto the end. He delivereth and rescueth, and he worketh signs and wonders in heaven and in earth, who hath delivered Daniel from the power of the lions. Daniel 6, verses 24 through 27. The first striking thing here is the fact of the retribution meted out to the enemies of Daniel. They had sought his downfall, digged a pit for him, and they fell into it themselves. God is not mocked, for whatsoever a man soweth, that shall he also reap. Galatians 6, 7. On the surface, it was Darius who thus so quickly dealt with those men, but back of him was the living God, the God of Daniel, who summarily took vengeance upon these conspirators. The heathen are sunk down in the pit that they made. In the net which they hid is their own foot taken. Jehovah is known by the judgment which he executeth. The wicked is snared by the work of his own hands. Psalm 9, verses 15 through 16. Darius made another decree and signed the writing, and according to the law of the Medes and Persians, it altereth not, that all his subjects should tremble and fear before the God of Daniel. He is also made to acknowledge the eternity of his counsel and the everlastingness of his kingdom, as well as his faithfulness and power. The king's panegyric of Jehovah is a mighty testimony to all Gentile powers to lay hands off the Jews. It is the voice of God to them. In his after years, Nebuchadnezzar made a similar edict. The world powers will do well if they heed these men's words. So this Daniel prospered in the reign of Cyrus the Persian. Daniel 6, verses 24 through 28. The last verse gives us the concluding record as to Daniel's official career. We read that he prospered in the reign of Darius and Cyrus, being chief president under the dual monarchy, even at the great age of almost a centenarian. Typical import. We have another and striking type of Gentile powers in our present lesson. Darius, sitting as God, whereby no petition was to be made to any God but to him for 30 days on pain of death, most vividly portrays the Antichrist, who will set himself up as God and demand worship of all the world. Revelation 13. Now, in looking at types, we must bear in mind that the question is not as to the personal character of him that affords a type. Darius appears to be a worthy man, but he is a figure, nevertheless, of an unworthy one. He foreshadows the usurpation by man of Christ's kingdom. This is manifested in the very first verse. It pleased Darius to set over the kingdom 120 princes, which should be over the whole kingdom. Does that not forcibly remind us of the day of Pentecost, with its 120 disciples sitting in that upper room, on thrones as it were, ready to reign, clothed with power from on high? That was a miniature portrait of the millennial kingdom, which would have come immediately had the nation of Israel responded to the overtures of Jehovah. But alas, they rejected all his offers of grace and blessing at that time. Hence, the coming kingdom of God has been delayed, and the way left open for the counterfeit king and kingdom, figured here by Darius and his princely court. At that place and having part in those affairs, Daniel represents some of the mighty men of the Jewish nation of the end time who will refuse to bow to the king of the revived Roman Empire or worship his image. They will, of necessity, be men of the upper 10 statesmen high up in the affairs of state, and the world emperor will hesitate to destroy them, but his convictions will be overruled by others. It may be that the two witnesses of John's revelation may be foreshadowed here, for we read that if any man will hurt them, he must in this manner be killed. Revelation 11:5. Those men that sought the death of Daniel and had him cast into the den of lions were themselves killed in this manner. Therefore, we have in this sixth chapter, combined with the three previous chapters, some typical happenings of the last week of Daniel's great prophecy, Daniel 9:27. There are so many phases of that 7 years of unparalleled week of marvels that not any one man nor any chapter could do justice to or figure the whole sphere of truth. With this lesson, we conclude the first division of the book of Daniel. The greater part of this portion, beginning with Daniel 2, 4, and ending with Daniel 7, was written in the Chaldean language, which fact is most significant. It is this part of the book which most closely concerns the people among whom he lived and to whom a prophecy written in Hebrew would have been unintelligible. The language is again Hebrew in the greater part of the second division, which has to do more with the future of the Jews, the people of Daniel. All of this only further enhances the word of our God and causes us to appreciate and value it more than ever. It is the only infallible book in the world. Division 2, Gentile World Powers, Internal View, Daniel chapters 7 through 12. The Vision of the Four Beasts, Daniel 7. In the first year of Belshazzar, king of Babylon, Daniel had a dream and visions of his head upon his bed, and he wrote the dream and told the sum of the matters. Daniel chapter 7, verse 1. With the above striking vision, the second part of Daniel opens. This was the first of four remarkable symbolic dreams concerning national affairs that were vouchsafed to the prophet in the latter years of his life, and which occupy the greater part of the second division of his prophecy. Daniel wrote the vision word for word as he saw and heard it, and he has handed it down to us that we may see and hear and understand. In the setting of the stage in this chapter, we are taken back some years. At the time of this vision, Belshazzar was in the first year of his reign. No doubt Daniel was left somewhat to oblivion during the first years of this dissolute young man's rulership. Earlier, we noted the fact of the king's ignorance of the prophet's very existence. Someone else had reminded him that there was such a wise man in his court. All of Daniel's previous interpretations and dissolving of doubts were unknown to Belshazzar. What did he care for old men and their wisdom? He was young and life was before him, so he figured. But suddenly he was halted in his madness. Another king took charge, a greater sovereign stepped upon the scene. His little soul shriveled in the presence of that unseen hand which wrote upon the wall. Ah, how little are the greatest, how weak the strongest, how awed the boldest when the majesty of God is sensed in even the slightest measure. Why, when even the comeliness of a Daniel is turned to corruption in the presence of deity, what effect must it have upon the one that forgets God and his prophets? Daniel 10, verse 8. At this point in his career, the retirement of Daniel only worked good for him. It gave him the opportunity he needed, the leisure that was necessary for him to qualify for the most important ministry of his varied career, namely, prophet of the times of the Gentiles. God was in every circumstance of this man's life, from the cradle to the coffin, and nothing that occurred in his life was trifling or unimportant. Here, as to his age, he was almost at the century mark, and yet the greatest epoch as to his usefulness had not been reached. He had not yet entered into all the good works to which he had been ordained. All that had gone before was only making him ready for the apex. He was in school, as it were, preparing by self-denial, faithfulness, purpose of heart, etc., for the better place on the program of the ages. God's great men are not made in a day. They are born in a moment, it is true, but they grow into greatness and favor with God by years of overcoming. Oh yes, some people argue that there are no full overcomers. Well, how about Daniel, the man called greatly desired? We admit there are few such, because the process is slow and the majority seek their own things. They will not be his captives, his prisoners, and let him work in them and make them weighty and powerful. There is so much chaff flying around today and calling itself wheat and thinking because it is so light and foolish that everyone else is the same. We say again, Daniel came to the zenith of his place and power when he was an old man. His hoary head was indeed a crown of glory. He entered into a prophetic ministry foretelling actual future events in which he has no peer except probably the Apostle John of apocalyptic fame. The two stand side by side in spirit on the Lord's Day as to their revelations, gazing at the same things but from different viewpoints. End time scenes are the subject of both their writings, but Daniel is revealing the exaltation of the earthly people, the Jew, in the kingdom and under the sway of their glorious Messiah, while John is entrancing us with the exaltation of the church, the heavenly company, in the kingdom and under the headship of the Lord Jesus Christ. Old men shall dream dreams. Daniel spake and said, I saw in my vision by night, and behold, the four winds of the heavens strove upon the great sea. And four great beasts came up from the sea, diverse one from another. The first was like a lion, and had eagle's wings. I beheld until the wings thereof were plucked, and it was lifted up from the earth and made to stand upon the feet, as a man, and a man's heart was given to it. And behold, another beast, a second, like unto a bear, and it raised up itself on one side, and it had three ribs in the mouth of it between the teeth of it. And they said unto it, Arise, destroy much flesh. After this I beheld, and lo, another like a leopard, which had upon the back of it four wings of a fowl. The beast also had four heads, and dominion was given to it. After this I saw in the night visions, and behold, a fourth beast, dreadful and terrible and strong exceedingly, and it had great iron teeth. It devoured and broke in pieces and stamped the residue with the feet of it, and it had 10 horns. I considered the 10 horns, and behold, there came up among them another little horn, before whom there were three of the first horns plucked up by the roots. And behold, in this horn were eyes like unto the eyes of a man, and a mouth speaking great things. Daniel 7, verses 2 through 8. The first impression we get after reading and meditating upon the above block of Scripture is the multum in parvo of the message in symbol. It is immense in its bearings and yet couched in such few words. How different if men had indicted its wonders. This vision, as well as the succeeding ones being presented to Daniel in symbols, required interpretation, which was also given to the prophet. Therefore, we need be in no doubt as to the meaning of them. We, of course, have the advantage over Daniel in the fact that we may read and investigate his visions after much that is written has become history. We would add that the fact of Daniel's revelations being fulfilled does not prove the interpretation correct, but only makes us to marvel at the truth of the interpretation as given to him, For the latter is not beclouded and obscure, needing history to make it plain and clear. We are assured that the prophet understood the symbolic visions, though we may read his book with the light afforded by earlier and contemporaneous prophets, as well as with that which later revelations afford, yet Daniel was not left in the dark. He knew what Jehovah was telling him, for some of the truth which he learned of the sorrows and exile of years that were coming to his people almost broke his heart. Daniel 8, verse 27. Therefore, Daniel is his own interpreter, not history, of the developments of the last days or any key of interpretation. The writing itself is sufficient. I beheld till the thrones were cast down, and the Ancient of Days did sit, whose garment was white as snow, and the hair of his head like the pure wool. His throne was like the fiery flame, and his wheels as burning fire. A fiery stream issued and came forth from him. Thousand thousands ministered unto him, and 10,000 times 10,000 stood before him. The judgment was set, and the books were opened. I beheld then because of the great words which the horn spoke. I beheld even till the beast was slain, and his body destroyed and given to the burning flame. As concerning the rest of the beasts, they had their dominion taken away, yet their lives were prolonged for a season and a time. I saw in the night visions, and behold, one like the Son of Man came with the clouds of heaven, and came to the Ancient of Days, and they brought him near before him. And there was given him dominion and glory and a kingdom, that all people, nations, and languages should serve him. His dominion is an everlasting dominion which shall not pass away, and his kingdom that which shall not be destroyed. Daniel 7, verses 9 through 14. Observe that the moving pictures, if we may so call them, were given in two reels, namely a terrestrial scene and a celestial one. The terrestrial scene was a procession of four beasts moving before the prophet's eyes, symbolizing earthly Gentile rule, the celestial scene symbolizing the heavenly rule of the Son of Man. The whole panorama must have been somewhat familiar to Daniel. He had interpreted Nebuchadnezzar's dream of the great image, with which much of this may be easily identified. There were several points of similarity. One, they were both presented in symbol, requiring interpretation for their unfolding. Two, in the first case, the symbols, representative of earth dominion, are suddenly terminated by the entrance of an entirely different order of picture, representative of the everlasting kingdom from the skies. Three, the succession of beasts in the moving picture presented to Daniel are four, the same number of the metals constituting the image of Nebuchadnezzar. Also, there is the same deterioration visible in regard to quality as well as to unity, as was manifested in the description of the image. The lion is the king of beasts, and he is seen as the first one. The bear is second in skill and strength. As seen in Daniel's vision, he held three ribs in his mouth. The leopard is slighter and weaker than the two former beasts and had four wings upon its back. Finally, the fourth, the terrible, unnameable beast, though exceedingly strong, yet is of lesser rank as he had no name. Also, he had 10 horns. The fourth point of resemblance is the emphasis placed upon the latest stages of the vision, and especially the utter destruction of all earth dominion by the coming in of the heavenly kingdom, as was seen in the symbolic image. The inspired interpretation. I, Daniel, was grieved in the midst of my body, and the visions of my head troubled me. I came near unto one of them that stood by and asked him the truth of all this. So he told me and made me to know the interpretation of the things. Daniel 7, verses 15 and 16. The marvelous drama which passed before the eyes of Daniel not only amazed him, but saddened his spirit, because there was much that he already understood which boded no good for his people. He was one with them. Their sorrows were his sorrows, their joy his joy. Therefore he was grieved with anxious concern as to their welfare. "What does it all signify?" was the query put to one of his heavenly visitants. And the angel gave him the interpretation of the entire vision, but not in detail. "These great beasts, which are four great kingdoms which shall arise out of the earth. But the saints of the Most High shall take and possess the kingdom forever, even forever and ever." Daniel 7, verses 17 and 18. The bare outline of the symbolic dream was given to Daniel, for that was all that was necessary. Because of its correspondence with the great image dream, of which he himself was the interpreter, he partly understood the matter. In this connection, we would again call attention to the fact that the word king may also be used for kingdom or empire, even covering the whole period of its duration, as we learned in Daniel 2. It was said to Nebuchadnezzar, "Thou art this head of gold, and after thee, the king, shall arise another kingdom." Daniel 2, verses 38 and 39. Here in our present lesson we read, "And the fourth beast shall be the fourth kingdom upon the earth." Daniel 7, verse 23. King and kingdom were employed in both cases to designate the one thing. Therefore, we do not think the prophet was very much in the dark as to the identity of the four beasts. He is only made aware in this manner of the character of these as viewed with anointed eyes, and in this aspect differing from the image which was manifested as man would see them. The prophet gazes upon these ferocious wild beasts arising out of waters troubled by the winds of heaven. He is naturally and supernaturally curious to learn what this agitated water as well as these winds signify. The answer is clear, and the plan is found in this book itself. By comparing Daniel 7:2 with Daniel 10:13 and 20, we learn that the winds represent powerful angelic forces, wicked spirits in control of earthly nations, which are plainly referred to there as the Prince of Persia and the Prince of Grecia. This also agrees with Ephesians 6:12, which states wicked spirits in the heavenlies, while Satan himself is called the Prince of the Power of the Air, the spirit that now worketh in the children of disobedience. Ephesians 2, verse 2. The natural map of the world has its spiritual counterpart in the heavens, where all national affairs have their inception and their execution. Satan himself being the source and advance agent of all of them. John, the seer of the New Testament, views an empire arising out of the sea having seven heads and ten horns, Revelation 13, which has its corresponding wicked spiritual kingdom of darkness, the dragon himself being king, Revelation 12:3. The sea out of which these beasts or world empires arise symbolizes the great mass of people. Isaiah informs us, "The wicked are like the troubled sea when it cannot rest," Isaiah 57:20. Winds or evil spirits moving upon the sea or nations trouble them. John corroborates Isaiah's testimony by saying, "The waters are peoples and multitudes and nations and tongues," Revelation 17:15. Out of these waters, or people, came forth the four empires which these four beasts symbolize. There is weakness and a deterioration noticeable in them as they follow one another, which would indicate that, in the divine view of these four world kingdoms, they descended in the scale as to governmental qualities. The lion, the first on the scene, is representative of Babylon. The most nearly perfect empire is thus symbolized by the king of beasts, for it more nearly resembled God's ideal of rulership, it was an undivided kingdom ruled over by one sovereign, Nebuchadnezzar. His conquest of the nation is likened to the majestic swoop of an eagle, the king of birds. Most striking, too, in this connection is the fact recorded that the wings thereof were plucked, his flying checked, emphasizing on the one hand his abasement even to the level of a beast at the very apex of his career of pride, and on the other hand of his elevation and restoration, in that the beast was finally made to stand upon his feet and a man's heart given unto him. The second, the bear, a most realistic figure of Medo-Persia, shows deterioration in that it was a dual empire, which fact was shown in the vision in that the bear raised itself up on one side, the Persian. Its conquest is shown to be slower, clumsier, and of a grosser type than that of its predecessor, as witness the three ribs crunched in its massive jaw representing Babylon, Lydia, and Egypt, the three great kingdoms that became one with it. The leopard, the third in the procession, fitly represents the Grecian Empire. In contrast with the slow and ponderous movements of the bear, it is quick and stealthy, approaching its prey warily but surely. The four wings upon its back would teach of the rapidity of the empire's conquest, unparalleled thus far in the history of the world. But notice that they are not the wings of an eagle, but of an inferior bird, therefore telling of deterioration. The latter fact is further emphasized by the division of the empire into four sections at the death of Alexander the Great, the renowned first emperor of Greece. The monster which follows, the fourth, is the one which gives the prophet the gravest concern. He was not able to classify him, for he had never seen his like before. The description of the beast is indescribably hideous. The ferocity and greed it displays are revolting. It had great iron teeth with which it devoured everything in its pathway. It ruthlessly broke in pieces everything that withstood its onward march. What it did not make its own, it crushed beneath its feet and thus spoiled it for others. This beast figures the Roman Empire, which Daniel described as dreadful and terrible and strong exceedingly. It was the most powerful of the world kingdoms and the one that stamped upon the Jew, breaking his power and dominion to the uttermost. Remember, Daniel was gazing upon the empires from the standpoint of his own people, seeing them through Jewish eyes, for no doubt they looked and acted beastly to the Jew. Especially so did this unnameable beast. The worst is yet to come in the last phase of the Roman Empire, for it is plainly evident from Scripture that there are two stages in its course. The latter, end stage of the deterioration in quality as well as unity, is most marked in the dream as witness to its divided condition. It had 10 horns, figurative of separate kingdoms. In its beginning, the Roman Empire did not possess these 10 kingdoms, though some expositors have tried to make them fit in to prove that all these things are past. But that is foolish. Scripture does not so instruct, and neither does history. Had that been the case, the 10 horns would have been on the beast when Daniel first looked upon it, coming up from the sea. Furthermore, it proved to be all that is therein described without the 10-horn phase. It was strong and fierce. It stamped the residue with its feet. It was diverse from all others. During the days of its ascendancy under the Caesars, Rome was all this, but it never could be said to have been so featured as having 10 horns before its dissolution, because the Roman Empire has ceased to exist. Therefore, we rightly conclude that it must rise again in the United Kingdom stage, which Daniel saw symbolized. He saw a wild beast at the first without horns, figuring imperial unity, Then later he gazed on the same beast with the 10 horns, which speaks of a divided kingdom. He carefully considered these later developments. They interested him, and then he saw something else. Another little horn makes its appearance. We may almost hear the prophet ask, "What does this signify?" Before we continue to look into the signification of this later feature of the Roman Empire at the end, we would call attention to an important distinction. We must not confound these 10 horns on the beast with the 10 toes on Nebuchadnezzar's image, though they are generally so confounded. Here is the one point where there is a divergence between these two symbolic dreams. The horns emphasize the national condition of the Roman Empire at the end of Gentile times, when their tenure of office, according to God's ordination, has run out, and the Jewish times are about to begin. The Jewish clock will be wound up and start to run at the very moment the Gentile clock stops. Daniel informs us that God will recognize 10 nations in particular. At the close of the times of the Gentiles, which have failed to qualify as to his ideal of government, and he is about to take the supremacy from them. But just at this juncture, the prophet is amazed to discover another little horn, which was not there previously. Plucking up 3 of the first horns by the roots, thus leaving only 7. These remaining horns are no doubt the 7 kings of John's vision in Revelation 17:10, which will rule over the 7 heads, or mountains, that is kingdoms, at the beginning of the 7 years of unfulfilled prophecy, Daniel 9:27. John saw this 7-headed empire arising out of the troubled sea, Revelation 18, just a little later than the time that Daniel is looking upon the beast losing 3 of its horns. The 10 toes of Nebuchadnezzar's image have their counterpart in the 10 horns of John's beast, Revelation 13, which are different from the 10 horns that Daniel viewed on his beast. During the latter part of the reign of Antichrist, the 10 horns on John's beast will be in power only 1 hour with the beast, Revelation 17:12. Daniel is deeply impressed with the newcomer among the horns. Although smaller than the others, he is no ordinary horn. Intelligence, wisdom, and excellency of speech are most strikingly portrayed by the language employed in his description. We would judge that he arrived at this vantage stage of his career by prowess of mind rather than strength or skill in battle. To a great extent, at the point of time that is figured here, he has control of the situation. The prophet is amazed at the turn of events, for according to God's decree, the end has come for the Roman Empire and all earthly rule, as the prophecy here indicates. Therefore, the rising kingdom, of which the little horn is the chief actor, will be as a 5th world empire, because it is a counterfeit of Christ's kingdom, which rightly is the 5th empire. The heavenly kingdom. I beheld till, Daniel 7:9, speaks of a change on the program. The first reel of the moving picture drama has almost run its course. The terrestrial scene is passing away. Man's day is closing. The second reel is about to be put on. The celestial scene is due. The Lord's day is at hand. As Daniel observes, he looked till the thrones were cast down or placed, and the Ancient of Days did sit. We learn from the interpretation of verse 18 that earthly dominion is being transferred from beasts to saints, which is certainly some change. The Gentile nations are set aside. Their times are over. Israel, the chosen nation, is coming into her place of supremacy over the earth, with the Lord himself on the throne as their king. The Ancient of Days is none other than Christ, but viewed as God Almighty. We have the same scene described for our instruction and edification as viewed by John, the New Testament seer. He shows us the same thrones placed in the heavens and the same majestic personage, Jehovah himself, the Creator, crowned with glory and honor, Revelation 4. These two visions are prophetic of the same time. They both figure the end of Gentile rule. Christ, as God, will take his seat upon his own throne. He is not sitting upon his Father's throne. Revelation 3, verse 21. But here is the marvelous and unthinkable thing which the majority of true Bible expositors have failed to see. From the moment that Christ's throne is set in the heavens, man's rule on the earth is a usurpation, and the 7 years that must be fulfilled afterward are a time beyond the order of God's appointment for the Gentile nations. The old man, energized by Satan, will refuse to abdicate in favor of the new man. Satan's man will not let go the reins of government in favor of God's man without a struggle. The last week of Daniel is a time of struggle between these opposing forces, and the earth is the battlefield. It is in this book we have this very situation symbolized and its consummation foretold. I beheld then, because of the voice of the great words which the horn spoke, Daniel 7:11. This statement figures the fact that the Roman Empire will seemingly be a factor in the world after the Lord has been seated upon his throne in the heavens. Observe that at this point in the second stage of its career, which is a very significant item, the little horn appears to be the whole empire. Where are the other horns which Daniel first saw upon the beast? Ah, they are of such slight importance that they barely are mentioned now. The newcomer appears to have the preeminence, which is exactly what prophecy declares concerning this man of ill fame, designated here as the little horn. He figures the Antichrist, who at this first appearance will occupy the role of one of the national heads or leaders of the world court or confederacy of nations, but will gradually get control of the whole empire. In John's vision of that unparalleled week of usurpation, we are informed that he saw one of the heads upon the beast, the United League of Nations, as though it were wounded to death, and his deadly wound was heralded, and all the world wondered after the beast. Revelation 13, verse 13. It is after this resurrection, for he will be a counterfeit of Christ, even as to his going down into death and coming up again, that he becomes sole ruler of the empire. See the section titled The Great World Powers in the study book on Revelation. As Jesus Christ is declared to be the Son of God with power by his resurrection from the dead, Romans 1:4, so the Antichrist will presume to prove that he is God by coming back from the dead. There are two aspects to his coming, as we noted. As is plainly evident from Scripture, the Antichrist counterfeits the two advents of Christ. Daniel does not make these two phases of his career stand out as does John. Nevertheless, they are found in his prophecy. The first view he gives of him is as the little horn coming in among or between the ten horns and mastering three of them. At this juncture in the picture, though he does not loom so large on the program, he demonstrates his ability and leadership, so that he, no doubt, attains to the place of one of the heads on the beast or counterfeit empire. He does not become the eighth head or horn, but one of the seven heads, Revelation 13. Later, Daniel's attention is focused upon the little horn because of the audacity of his words. He becomes great, vaunting himself in his pride and self-will, reminding us of the man of sin, whom Paul tells us will sit as God, showing himself that he is the Supreme One, 2 Thessalonians 2, blasphemous in his attitude toward the only true and living God. Observe at this point in the vision that Daniel identifies the horn and the beast as one, Daniel 7:11. Furthermore, he is clearly distinguished from the other beasts or horns, which proves his unique place, Daniel 7:12. We have another feature of great importance added to Daniel's testimony regarding the little horn's career. He made war with the saints and prevailed against them, Daniel 7:21. But this war on the saints is limited. It only continues until the Ancient of Days makes his appearance. Then they prevailed against their former prevailer. Judgment was given to the saints of the Most High, Daniel 7:22. It is this phase of the little horn's career that sorely troubles Daniel. His people's suffering touches him. He inquires more fully as to this troubler of Israel who was to be destroyed by the interposition of God himself, and he gets further information. Jehovah delights to impart such knowledge to his people that are interested. He tells the prophet the following: "The fourth beast shall be the fourth kingdom upon the earth, which shall be diverse from all kingdoms upon earth, and shall devour the whole earth, and shall tread it down and break it in pieces. The ten horns out of this kingdom are ten kings that shall arise. Another shall arise after them, and he shall be diverse from them, and he shall subdue three kings." Daniel 7, verses 23 through 24. The above is unmistakably clear and plain. Any man, it seems, can understand from the answer to Daniel that God only recognizes four Gentile world empires. The above describes the fourth or last of these powers. The first stage of its rise and development is outlined in Daniel 7, verse 23. The dissolution of this kingdom, the Roman Empire, lies between verses 23 and 24 of Daniel 7. Hence, when we read of the ten horns on the beast, we are reading of the beginning of the end stage, the 7 years of usurpation of the fourth kingdom. From the standpoint of God and his word, it is a most important epoch in the history of the world. It is the consummation period, the apex of man's doings. His blasphemous denial of God and his refusal to acknowledge Jehovah's sovereignty of the world are herein symbolized. In the first stage of the fourth empire, while it was beastly and bloodthirsty in the sight of God, it was in divine order. But in the second stage, it will be set up in defiance of God. At the very hour when God's clock shall strike, the times of the Gentiles will be fulfilled, and he will proceed to place his son, the seed of Abraham and the seed of David, upon his throne in the heavens. But the nations will rebel against Jehovah's decree. The kings of the earth will unite, and the rulers will take counsel together against the Lord and against his anointed, saying, "Let us break their bands asunder, let us cast away their cords from us." Psalm 2, verses 2 and 3. But the Lord will have something to say as to that decision. "He that sitteth in the heavens shall laugh at their puny efforts to thwart his plans and purposes. He shall have them in derision," Psalm 2, verse 4, "and crown his king, Christ, a short time before the League of Nations or counterfeit empire is launched. Therefore, the latter getting together of the world powers is in rebellion against God's decree as to his son's right to reign." Daniel 7:25 informs us further of its anger and enmity. "And he shall speak great words against the Most High, and shall wear out the saints of the Most High, and think to change times and laws, and they shall be given into his hand until a time and times and the dividing of time." The above describes the second stage of the Antichrist's career in few words. The kingdom, which will arise with ten kings in coalition and equality, is now phrased as one king. He, the little horn, the terrible man of destiny, arises in symbol and is seen in control of the world. The devil having given him his place as God of this world, 2 Thessalonians 2:9. The great words he speaks are words of defiance directed especially against Christ, who is here spoken of as the Most High. He is Israel's Messiah who will be on his throne at the time figured, and they are the saints that are to share the earthly kingdom. The Gentile Lord will vent his ire upon them. He will wear them out, as Daniel says, and attempt to change their times, their feasts, and their laws. In other words, he desires power, absolute, invincible, despotic authority over all men, over their consciences, religion, and life. He will have this period of sovereignty a short time. For 3.5 years, he will reign as Satan, the arch-fiend and eternal enemy of God. Jehovah will allow this defiant and malignant destroyer undisputed sway as judgment upon all men for their rebellion against him and their king. The world will find his burden heavy, his yoke anything but easy. To the Jewish people especially, it will be a time of unparalleled tribulation, the finishing touch, as it were, to their long time of chastisement, out of which a remnant will be saved to suffer no more forever. That will be the time of suffering that is spoken of as the Great Tribulation, Matthew 25, and Jacob's Trouble, Jeremiah 30, which Jesus said must be shortened or no flesh should be saved. The destroyer of Israel, the soon coming Caesar, would wipe these people of destiny, the Jews, off the face of the earth, but he cannot do it. God is for them, and no one can be against them, only so long as God allows the trial. The end of their enemy will come. They will cry to the living God for help, and Jesus, their Messiah, will arrive post-haste for their deliverance and the destruction of the Antichrist. The judgment shall sit, and they shall take away his dominion to consume and destroy it unto the end. And the kingdom and dominion and the greatness of the kingdom under the whole heaven shall be given to the saints of the Most High, whose kingdom is an everlasting kingdom, and all dominions shall serve and obey him. Daniel 7, verses 26 through 27. This surely could not be more explicit or rendered clearer. After God's determined times for the Gentiles shall have closed, the usurpation of Gentile rulership shall end in judgment and the annihilation of the counterfeit empire. After that, the Messiah of Israel will be received by the holy remnant, and he will bring them into the kingdom promised to them in Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. He will place them forever in power on the earth, and he will reign over all the kingdoms of the world, the blessed and only potentate, the King of Kings and Lord of Lords, 1 Timothy 6:15. One of these days, all earth scenes will be changed, all of the ways of men be disarranged. Mighty and pompous things will then go down, people of wealth and wisdom lose renown. One of these days, a stone cut not with hands, then will amaze the nations, break their bands. Jesus our Lord will reign in righteousness over the earth, and Jews and Gentiles bless one of these days. One of these days our Lord will call us home. One of these days we'll cease on earth to roam. All of our toils and tears will then be o'er. Upward on wings of faith to heaven we'll soar one of these days. One of these days with Christ within the throne, enveloped in praise, we'll reap what we have sown. Then we will wear a golden glory crown and with the Savior share his great renown. One of these days, A.S. Copley. Vision of the Ram and Goat, Daniel 8. In the third year of the reign of King Belshazzar, a vision appeared unto me, even unto me, Daniel, after that which appeared unto me at the first, Daniel 8, 1. This second panorama of future events passed before Daniel's eyes 3 years after the vision of the four beasts. There are several points of contrast between the two. in Daniel 7, we are not given the name of the place of the vision, neither does Daniel appear to record it, but rather another person. Yet we know that such is not the case. Daniel wrote the whole book which bears his name, and in our present chapter, he mentions the former vision of 3 years previous. We repeat, these things are significant. The inference is that the events figured by the four beasts are so entirely Gentile that Daniel, the Jew, does not write as though he was recording the vision, while on the contrary, the ram and goat vision is reported by Daniel, doubly emphasized as me, even me, Daniel. No doubt it figures happenings relative to the Jews and their land. The scene of this vision is laid in the palace of Shushan, later the capital city of the Medo-Persian kingdom. The fact that the prophet was transported thither in the dream prepares us for a change and implies that the dynasty of Babylon was about to end. The present moving picture was thrown on the screen in the last year of Belshazzar's reign. Daniel appears to be in another kingdom, country, and palace. Babylon seems entirely lost to his view, for his vision has no reference to the city of Babylon nor to the world empire of that name. The panorama. I lifted up mine eyes and saw, and behold, there stood before the river a ram which had two horns, and the two horns were high, but one was higher than the other, and the higher came up last. I saw the ram pushing westward and northward and southward, so that no beast might stand before him, neither was there any that could deliver out of his hand. But he did according to his own will and became great. And as I was considering, behold, a he-goat came from the west on the face of the whole earth and touched not the ground. And the goat had a notable horn between his eyes. And he came to the ram that had two horns, which I had seen standing before the river, and ran unto him in the fury of his power. And I saw him come close unto the ram, and he was moved with choler against him, and smote the ram, and broke his two horns. And there was no power in the ram to stand before him. But he cast him down to the ground, and stamped upon him, and there was none that could deliver the ram out of his hand. Therefore the he-goat waxed very great, and when he was strong, the great horn was broken. And for it came up four notable ones toward the four winds of heaven. Daniel 8, verses 3 through 8. Here the two outstanding figures of the ram and goat must have presented an impressive picture to Daniel. He could no doubt easily identify the first one, the ram, with the bear kingdom of his previous vision, interpreted as that of Medo-Persia. The same dual character is indicated by the two horns and the fact that the one of them, that came up last, becomes higher, which points to the later supremacy of Persia over Media. Also, the fact of the ram's conquest of three countries, westward, northward, and southward, agrees with the symbol of the three ribs in the mouth of the bear. The description of the second figure, the goat, while much more detailed than that of the leopard of Daniel 7, yet it has many of its essentialities. The same swiftness of approach and the abrupt fourfold division are parallel in each case. Daniel could easily trace its correspondence not only with his earlier vision, but also with the symbolic dream image which he had interpreted for Nebuchadnezzar. They are all three identical thus far. The little horn. And out of one of them came forth a little horn which waxed exceeding great toward the south and toward the east and toward the pleasant land. And it waxed even great to the host of heaven and cast down some of the host and of the stars to the ground and stamped upon them. Yet he magnified himself even to the prince of the host, and by him the daily sacrifice was taken away, and the place of his sanctuary was cast down. And a host was given him against the daily sacrifice by reason of transgression, and it cast down the truth to the ground, and it practiced and prospered. Daniel 8, 9-12. From this point on, Daniel must have begun to trace a difference in the moving picture drama from all that had preceded. Here we have a decided change in the real, and the latter purpose is really the occasion of the second vision of the seer. God never just simply repeats himself. There is always some further light and instruction for us in every apparent repetition. Let us follow on here and see if we can find the difference between this vision and that of the preceding chapter and what it portends. First, note the reference to the pleasant land, which signifies Palestine, in connection with the activities of the little horn. Also, the expression "the host of heaven" is clearly speaking of Daniel's own people, the Jews. The latter are the only people on the earth that can be termed in any sense a heavenly host. The stars signify the spiritual leaders of the people who are their luminaries. Furthermore, observe the dreadful condition of pride and defiance against the prince of the people and the desecration of the daily sacrifice and the sanctuary, verse 11. But the next verse informs us of the why of the foregoing. It is by way of judgment upon the host of heaven. For a specified time, the people of Daniel will be wholly given over into the hand of this sacrilegious, godless fellow designated here the little horn. All of the above summary of events peculiar to this second vision stamp it as altogether of a religious character. It connects with the vision of Daniel 7, but is not the same. Neither are the two little horns of these two chapters synonymous. The first refers to a Gentile king, the last great world emperor, while the one we are now considering applies to a Jew, we believe a religious man. We say again that the vision here outlined is peculiarly significant of Daniel's own people and their land. Remember that this chapter, as well as the remainder of this book, was written in Hebrew, which especially fits this pilgrim race, while the preceding part was written in the Chaldean language. The further fact that Daniel affixes his name to this portion is significant, as we have noted before. Then I heard one saint speaking, and another saint said unto that certain saint which spake, "How long shall be the vision concerning the daily sacrifice and the transgression of desolation to give both the sanctuary and the host to be trodden underfoot?" And he said, "Unto 2,300 days, then shall the sanctuary be cleansed." Daniel 8, verses 13 and 14. Now we see that there is a slight digression from the vision proper. Daniel is given to see in his dream the importance of the desecration occasioned by the wicked ruler, designated the little horn, and the concern with which the saints, the religious people, will regard the events shadowed here. The one interested saint inquires of the other the length of time in which the sanctuary and the host shall be trodden underfoot. The temple and the people of Jehovah are in question. How long shall the desecration continue? How long shall the judgment of Jehovah be visited upon the people? How long until the sanctuary is cleansed? It is really the uppermost thought, as the answer with its connecting appendage shows. Therefore, we are in no doubt as to the meaning of this moving picture. In the last days, Daniel's own people are shown upon the screen in dire trouble because of the evil doings of the little horn. Their land and their sacred house are polluted because of his presence. It is a judgment upon them because of their transgressions, but it is only for a time. There will follow a glorious vindication. In the vision, we are brought to this happy consummation by way of the first reel showing the moving picture of the second and third world empires, down to the coming of the vile person, the oppressor of the Jews, who shall spring out of one of the four divisions of the third empire. That is, judgment precedes blessing. Daniel's attitude to the vision. And it came to pass when I, Daniel, had seen the vision and sought for the meaning, then, behold, there stood before me as the appearance of a man. And I heard a man's voice between the banks of Ulahi, which called and said, Gabriel, make this man to understand the vision. So he came near to where I stood, and when he came, I was afraid and fell upon my face. But he said unto me, Understand, O son of man, for at the time of the end shall be the vision. Now as he was speaking with me, I was in a deep sleep on my face toward the ground. But he touched me and set me upright, and he said, Behold, I will make thee know what shall be in the last end of the indignation, for at the time appointed the end shall be. Daniel 8, verses 15 through 19. The first part of the vision was no mystery to Daniel. He knew its connection and identity with what had preceded. But the latter part was what interested him. Its undoubted application to his own people filled him with desire for the solution of the whole panorama. He must understand it. He sought the meaning, no doubt, calling on God for the answer, and it was not long in coming. The angel Gabriel is sent to him to make him to understand the vision. It pleased the Lord that Daniel should be so interested and seek to know all the truth concerning the matter. We cannot be too earnest or zealous in desiring a knowledge of the purposes of God. He delights in this form of curiosity and deigns to condescend to our ignorance. The angel draws near to this man and speaks, telling him to understand, that is, giving him the opened ear and understanding heart. Daniel is afraid and falls upon his face, but Gabriel touches him and makes him stand upon his feet, saying, Behold, I will make thee know. Daniel was to have his heart's desire granted to him. And we will also, if we seek after knowledge as men seek after fine gold. When we get the interpretation from heaven, as in the case here, we can depend upon its accuracy and inspiration. Daniel did not doubt the angel's words. He believed implicitly that he was getting the understanding of that for which his heart was crying. Let us notice at the outset the angel's procedure of instruction. He seeks to fix Daniel's attention upon the last days. The end is emphasized by three references. 1, the time of the end, verse 17. 2, the last end. And 3, at the time appointed the end shall be, verse 19. Herein we have the key to the solution of the mystery. It relates to matters concerning Daniel's own people way down to the last end of this age, or more properly speaking, the first 7 years of the next age. The book of Daniel begins with the captivity of the Jew, as we have seen previously. The prophet himself, being then but a boy in his teens, was taken down to Babylon at the time of the very first siege against Jerusalem. That marked the beginning of the domination of the Gentiles. Nebuchadnezzar, who was his father's general at that time, came up and made Jehoiakim king of Judah, who was subject to Nabopolassar in 606 BC. Jehovah's long-restrained indignation began to be poured out upon his rebellious people. The threatened judgment fell, and they were cast out of their beautiful land which had been given to them by Jehovah. This disrupted condition of the nation had now obtained, or prevailed, for 70 years, which brings us up to the year of this vision, Daniel 8. Daniel was aware of all these things which had fallen upon his people, for he was in the first deportation of captives. He knew the people were suffering as subject to Gentile rule because of God's hand and indignation. Therefore, the words of the angel, the last end of the indignation, could only have one meaning for him. He understood that the vision referred to the final and as yet unreached end of the judgment time, when their expulsion from the land would be a thing of the past. He realized that Jehovah was unveiling the closing stage of this meted out, down-treading chastisement of his people, preparatory to their restoration to their place of supremacy upon the earth. Hence, he fixes his attention upon the last days of the times of the Gentiles. We are assured from his sickness, sorrow, and astonishment when he hears the sum of the matter that he knew the end was not in sight, but was yet for many days, as the angel informs him, Daniel 8:26. The interpretation. The ram which thou sawest having two horns are the kings of Media and Persia, and the rough goat is the king of Grecia, and the great horn between his eyes is the first king. Now that being broken, whereas four stood up for it, four kingdoms shall stand up out of the nation, but not in his power. Daniel 8, verses 20 through 22. The ram is a well-known symbol of Persia, used in that country itself and very familiar in its monuments and public documents. But it is marvelous how its composite character is revealed and emphasized by its two horns. These two kingdoms, Media and Persia, lying eastward from Babylon, were already battering at her gates, for as history informs us, the end arrived for Belshazzar in the third year of his reign. Darius is said to have reigned but a short time when he gave up the entire rulership to his superior Cyrus. There are several differing views of the Mede and the eclipse by the Persian, but here we have the prophecy of the fact from which there can be no dissenting voice. This great empire, as we intimated in our last lesson, held three great kingdoms in its grasp: Babylon, Egypt, and Lydia, besides many lesser powers which were included in the first empire and was vastly more extended in its territory than that of its predecessor, Babylon. The rough goat is plainly said to be Greece, the third kingdom. Here is the first hint of the ascendancy of a Western power. Hitherto, the East has had it all her own way. Even in Daniel's time, there was no indication of the change. Greece was plainly no formidable opponent when this prophetic vision was given to Daniel. It is this fact that makes the critics howl. They cannot dispute the future events herein declared years before they became history. They can only deny the authenticity of Daniel's writings, claiming that they were the work of one who lived many years later. But we know differently. Inspiration breathes from every page of this book. It is marvelously divine. None but God can tell things before they come to pass. He challenges men, or their idols, to do as he has done and thus prove their claim. He cites the fulfillment of prophecy as the unanswerable proof that he is God. Isaiah 41, verses 21 through 26. Furthermore, as regards the interpretation of the vision and the prophecy declared therein, at that time Greece was anything but prosperous. She had already lost her holdings in Asia Minor to Crassus, ruler of Lydia. Yet here in this striking prophecy, it is shown as coming into prominence at the very zenith of the Persian Empire, when the latter, without a rival, was walking upon the earth in every direction. The marvel is that the conquering adversary should be a Western power. From the quarter least to be expected comes the victor. The Persian did not get the goat, but the goat, the Grecian conqueror, went home with the spoils. His power was marvelous. He touched not the ground, incredible swiftness featured. The notable horn on the goat was the first king of Greece, as the angel revealed to Daniel in Daniel 8, verses 5 through 8. Here is the well-known conqueror, Alexander the Great. His amazing progress is noted as phenomenal in profane history. It is said that at the age of 32, he wept because there were no more worlds to conquer. He became dominant over all the then known world and died, while still young, of fever, the result of drunken excesses at Babylon. He had no natural seed, his own brother and the latter's two sons being murdered within the space of 15 months, and the Grecian Empire was divided among Alexander's four generals who had fought and conquered with him. The eastern portion became known as the East, or Chaldea, and its ruler was Seleucus. The western provinces were called Greece and had for their king Cassander. The northern part was named Asia Minor and given to Lysimachus. Egypt in the south had Ptolemy as ruler. The partition weakened the empire. The fierce one of the end. In the latter time of their kingdom, when the transgressions are come to the full, a king of fierce countenance and understanding dark sentences shall stand up. And his power shall be mighty, but not by his own power. And he shall destroy wonderfully, and shall prosper and practice, and shall destroy the mighty. And through his policy also he shall cause craft to prosper in his hand, and he shall magnify himself in his heart, and by peace shall destroy many. He shall also stand up against the prince of princes, but be broken without hand. Daniel 8, verses 23 through 25. Now that we have some positive data as to the interpretation of the vision, we must not forget the fact that the end is the point upon which the angel sought to focus Daniel's attention. The little horn which was to arise out of one of the four notable kingdoms that succeeded the divided Grecian empire is called by the angel a king of fierce countenance. We see in the first part of the moving picture the detailed portion that this little horn becomes powerful in the east, Babylon, and in the pleasant land. But the northern and western portions are not mentioned in this connection. Therefore, we conclude that the king of ill fame comes from one of these sections of the empire, that is, from either Greece or Asia Minor. While we look to the end for this man to appear, yet we also naturally look for some character of the past from one of those kingdoms to answer in some measure to the description of this fierce one. As history declares, there was such a personage in the past, Antiochus Epiphanes. Antiochus Epiphanes fits into this place most marvelously. He came from Syria, one of the countries of Asia Minor, the northern partition of the Grecian Empire. His cruelty to the Jews, sacrilege to their house of worship, and desecration of the Holy Land are common history. Many Bible expositors insist that the little horn's career has been fulfilled in this Syrian king. If we do not fix our eyes tenaciously upon the words spoken by the angel as to the last end of the indignation, we too may be misled as to the application. There are further points of evidence that must convince the open-hearted that the language cannot apply to Antiochus in the full sense that is here intimated. Antiochus did not tread the sanctuary and host underfoot for the specified time of 2,300 days. In other words, 6 years, 4 months, and 20 days. In fact, although they were fiercely and persistently assailed, the Jews successfully withstood Antiochus because Jehovah was with them and fought for them. They won for themselves a great name, becoming more prosperous and independent than they had been since the disruption of the kingdom and carrying away into Babylon. That was under the Maccabees and was typical of Christ's coming kingdom. Antiochus has been called the Antichrist of the Old Testament, and he is a most striking figure of the reality which is yet to come. In many points, he resembled the false prophet or second beast, Revelation 13, 15 through 17, whom we believe is the answer to this little horn of Daniel. Antiochus attempted to force heathen worship upon the Jews, and he put to death all those that resisted his designs, until at last the Maccabees, the heroic, faithful Jewish leaders, assisted by the Romans, defeated him. It is said he profaned the temple by offering a sow upon the altar of burnt offering, which effectually put an end to Jewish worship for a short time. The temple was eventually cleansed, and the ordained sacrifices and worship resumed. All this is truly significant and typical of another and far worse blasphemer, the king of fierce countenance of the last days. The angel has put the interpretation of the latter part of the vision beyond doubt or uncertainty. In the latter time of their kingdom, when the transgressors are come to the full, a king of fierce countenance shall stand up. The time of Antiochus was the former time of these respective kingdoms. Their cup of iniquity was not yet full. His day was not even in the latter time of the parted Grecian Empire, for he died more than 100 years before its dissolution. The language here proves that there is to be a revival of those four kingdoms. They are to have a latter time, and out of one of them this fierce fellow will arise. The inference is plain that he will not be of Chaldea or Egypt, for he seems to become strong in those quarters and in the pleasant land. All these facts imply that he conquers these portions, whether by a bloodless conquest or not, we do not say, though we incline to the former view. For we believe that this man figures the false prophet, the second beast, companion in crime and deception with the first beast, Revelation 13, figured by the little horn of Daniel 7. Observe some of the statements regarding him. His power shall be mighty, but not by his own power, Daniel 8:24. This implies superhuman resources, therefore it must be Satan's empowerment. This is what we read of the false prophet, for though he looks gentle and guileless as a lamb, yet he spoke as a dragon. We read further, he doeth great wonders so that he maketh the fire come down from heaven on the earth in the sight of men, and deceiveth those that dwell on the earth by the means of the miracles which he hath power to do in the sight of the beast, saying to those that dwell on the earth that he should make an image to the beast which had a wound by a sword and did live. And he had power to give life unto the image of the beast, that the image should speak and cause that as many as would not worship the image of the beast should be killed. And he causeth all, both rich and poor, free and bond, to receive a mark in their foreheads, and that no man might buy or sell, save he that had the mark of the beast or the number of his name. Revelation 13, verses 11 through 17. These two men, called beasts by John, the Daniel of the New Testament, work hand in glove. They are both energized and filled by Satan. The one cannot be separated from the other, for they are both antichrist, anti-king, and anti-prophet. It takes two men to counterfeit Christ in these two offices. In his first advent, Christ was Messiah, the prophet. In his second advent, he will be Messiah, the king. The second beast works for the first beast and in harmony with him. Together, they will influence the world nationally and religiously. The first beast will arise from the sea, the restless, troubled mass of the people, multitudes, and nations. The second beast will come from the quiet, steady, apparently established religious element, without observation or acclaim, the opposite in this respect from the first. He will seemingly be modest and weak. We see him in John's description as a lamb with two horns, not a wild beast, even as Daniel also shows him coming from the goat kingdom, not a wild beast, as in chapter 7. The lamb speaks of sacrifice, as also the goat. This beast being an imitation of Christ as priest, as well as prophet. The two horns upon the lamb tell us of his cosmopolitan character. He is for all men, both Jews and Gentiles. As the first beast will be the world's greatest conqueror, emperor of empires, so the second beast will be the world's greatest prophet. In men's eyes, these two men will be great characters. They will be supreme. The world will obey the one and worship the other. They will aptly characterize the end of man's day, for they will be giants in intellect and might. All the subtlety and craft of Satan will be epitomized in these super beings. They will cause the world to wonder and perish, For their coming is after the working of Satan with all power and signs and lying wonders, 2 Thessalonians 2:8 through 9. While the latter is especially significant of the second beast, yet it is by the same power, that of Satan, that the first beast is given his place of authority. These two men are mentioned in their respective offices noted by several writers and always in connection with each other, calling the first beast a thief and a wolf, and the second beast the hireling, shepherd, that flees when danger approaches, in contrast with the good shepherd who dies for the sheep. Paul speaks of them also as was intimated. He terms the first beast the man of sin, the son of perdition, closely associating him with that wicked, the second beast, whom the Lord shall consume with the spirit of his mouth and destroy with the brightness of his coming, 2 Thessalonians 2:8. Furthermore, in Job we have these two men connected again, figured by two great beasts, the behemoth, a land animal, and Leviathan, a beast of the sea, Job 40 and 41. David also speaks of them as the violent man, the king or first beast, and the evil man, the wicked and evil speaker, the prophet or second beast. See Psalm 140 verses 1, 4, and 11. Therefore, we rightly conclude that Daniel could not have neglected to tell us of so great a personage as the second beast of the end. Surely he would not prophesy of one beast, Daniel 7, and not inform us of the other. The second beast is even more closely related to the Jew and his land than the first. If the little horn of Daniel 8 is not the second beast of Revelation 13, where will we find him in Daniel? Why should Daniel be the only prophet who is silent concerning him? Indeed, we have a most striking prophecy of him in our present chapter. His victories are rather religious than national, as the language proves. He shall understand dark sentences, and he shall destroy wonderfully, and shall prosper, and shall destroy the mighty and the holy people, the Jews. All the power that is supernatural power and signs and wonders are attributed to him. He doeth great wonders, John tells us in Revelation 13:13. His miracles will be in imitation of God's judgments upon the earth. They will deceive all but the very elect. Jannes and Jambres, the magicians, false prophets of Egypt that withstood Moses, figure these two beasts with their counterfeit signs. The second beast of John, or second horn of Daniel, will persuade the people to make an image of the first beast, his likeness, no doubt, which will be set up in the temple in Jerusalem, and all men commanded to worship it. Nebuchadnezzar's great image on the plain of Dura is an illustration and forerunner of this parody. Breath, not life, see margin, will be given to the image, and it will speak and demand that all those shall be put to death that refuse to fall down and worship the image. That will be the abomination that maketh desolate, to which the Lord referred in Matthew 24:15, Daniel 9:27, and Daniel 12:11. And he causeth all, both small and great, rich and poor, free and bond, to receive a mark in their right hand or in their foreheads, Revelation 13:16. Whatsoever that mark will be, and there have been many suppositions, we are assured that it is a satanic counterfeit of the sealing of the people of God by the Holy Spirit, Revelation 13:17. No doubt it will be some indication by the hand or in the mind, a paper probably on which a password is written, or the knowledge of the word or words in the mind, of allegiance to the first beast and the empire over which he holds sway, that carries with it the promise of protection and favor. No one may buy or sell except he worships the beast and shows loyalty to his devil-inspired government. Remember, it is the second beast that supports all the claims of the first beast or Antichrist by power. Observe also that several of the characteristics of Daniel's little horn of our present chapter agree most perfectly with John's account of the second beast. And through his policy also he shall cause craft to prosper in his hand, and he shall magnify himself in his heart, and by peace shall destroy many. He shall also stand up against the prince of princes, but he shall be broken without hand. Daniel 8:25. Here we are shown the manner in which he will accomplish his diabolical schemes, by diplomacy, craft, self-exaltation, and deception. He will be the religious leader of the end, especially the Jews will hail him as prophet. He may be a Jew himself, or at least one of the tribes of Israel. Why not? They were carried down to Syria, the country from which Daniel's little horn will probably emerge. He will have great influence with Daniel's people at the end, moving them, no doubt, to make the covenant, which Isaiah terms a covenant with death and hell, with the revived Roman Empire and its emperor. See Isaiah 28, verse 15. The latter will no doubt stand for peace and protection of all peoples, but later it will bring sorrow, tribulation, and death to the Jews. But the pinnacle of the blasphemy of the little horn is manifested in his stand against the Prince of Princes, which is none other than Christ himself. He is described as defying him and resisting his advances to take hold of what is his own. But the result of his malignancy is that he shall be broken without hand, that is, by supernatural power. John writes, "He goeth into perdition." Revelation 17:11. And the beast was taken, and the false prophet that wrought miracles before him, with which he deceived them that had received the mark of the beast and them that worshipped his image, these both were cast alive into a lake of fire burning with brimstone. Revelation 19:20. The angel's last words, "And the vision of the evening and the morning which was told is true. Wherefore, shut thou up the vision, for it shall be for many days." Daniel 8, verse 26. The above must have been disconcerting and discouraging to the heart of Daniel. Here was the very end of the 70 years of the prophesied captivity, Jeremiah 25:12, when he was expecting the downfall of Babylon. And now he is told that the end of the indignation is not in sight. It is yet for many days. Although Babylon, the great city of the Chaldean Empire, the boast and pride of Nebuchadnezzar, did fall as Daniel himself records, Daniel 5, yet the domination of the Jews still remains a fact in the world. The times of the Gentiles have not ended, regardless of the declaration of Balfour and the exit from Jerusalem of Ottoman rule. The captivity of the Jew is still a fact, as conditions all about us witness. Some expositors insist that the many days, Daniel 8:26, refer to the 2,300 days, the length of time of the desolated sanctuary, Daniel 8:14. But we are assured that these are two separate periods of time. The one, many days, spoken by the angel to Daniel, in which the vision is shut up, refers to these years of the domination of the Jew by Gentile powers, while the other, the definite number of days, the answer of the one saint to the other, refers entirely to the very end of the indignation, the 7 years of unparalleled happenings yet to be fully fulfilled relative to the chastisement of the Jew. The inference is plain that at the point where these allotted days begin, the captivity of Daniel's people is over, for they are in their own land and are again a recognized people in the world. The daily sacrifice could not have been said to have been taken away, Daniel 8:11, if it had not been in evidence. Therefore, we rightly infer that the temple will have been built and their worship of Jehovah resumed sometime previously. Now, here is the absolute proof that we are correct in our assumption that the last week of Daniel is a usurpation by the Gentiles of the kingdoms of this world in defiance of God. Their tenure of office ends when the captivity of the Jew ends, Luke 21:24. Hence, any further sovereignty on their part is in rebellion against the edict of Jehovah. He has decreed for them four world empires, Daniel 2 and Daniel 7, no more and no less. Therefore, the last world empire, which is shortly to arise, will be out of divine order. The Gentile times will stop, according to God, when the Jews' clock is wound up and starts ticking again. At that very moment, God has his king, a Jew, the Lord Jesus Christ, ready, and he seats him amid the acclamations of heaven, if not of earth, upon his throne in the heavens, which has been placed there, and the fifth world empire begins to come into view. The Jews' times will then commence, but they as a nation will be still in unbelief as to Jesus Christ. They will not yet accept him as their Messiah. In fact, we learn from another time date in Daniel 12:11, that 30 days previous to the setting up of the throne of Christ in the heavens, the daily burnt offering is interrupted. The latter figures Christ and his fragrant death. Therefore, when they let go of this sacred symbol, they are refusing their king and accepting the Antichrist, the usurper.